This is A Question of Balance on 2SER 107.3 FM, and I'm Ruby Vincent. On A Question of Balance, we're returning to one of my favourite topics, and that is the Australian white ibis. And we're joined by a pretty unusual person, and that is Sean Coogan. The reason he's unusual is he's just handed in his PhD thesis. You don't really get people at that moment in their life. And the other thing is he's just managed to get some of the work published in a prestigious journal in the field, which means that, well, he's kind of probably home and hosed to get his PhD accepted. Except you can never be sure of anything in this world these days. Look at the elections in a number of countries recently. Thank you so much for joining us, Sean. I've looked at your research and it covers a lot of fields. Perhaps we should have a little bit about your background, first of all.
Hi, Ruby. Yeah, I came here from Canada to study my PhD here at the University of Sydney. What I was involved in back in Canada was studying grizzly bears, actually. So basically what they eat, the seasonality of the different foods they eat. And so I got into reading the literature on nutritional ecology, and I came across stuff by my supervisor here, actually, David Robbenheimer. And I decided that I wanted to study with him. And that's what brought me to Australia. So what I've been doing here is just generally looking at how animals kind of how animals basically forage and how they select the foods that they eat from kind of a nutrient-based perspective. So looking at the macronutrients that animals choose and how they balance that. So a lot of people might not realize that animals and humans as well, there's evidence for, actually regulate their nutrient intake. And the macronutrients, so protein, fats, and carbohydrates, a really strong driver of this foraging behavior. So animals won't just eat randomly or eat whatever or eat to maximize energy intake. They'll actually prefer different ratios of macronutrients, and it varies between species. So part of what I do is kind of look at how different animals, how they regulate their nutrient intake, and also compare between species to look at the differences and the patterns involved in that.
Well, I think the only thing that most people know about animals choosing things deliberately to eat is cows licking salt licks that we've all heard of and probably never seen. But I'm intrigued by you saying that our ordinary animals choose specific kinds of foods in different seasons. Does that mean that something that is maybe basically a seed eater in one season might be basically, I don't know, an insect eater or some other general diet?
It kind of depends on the animal and how they, basically the type of diet they have. So if I go back to the grizzly bear, which is really a very omnivorous animal. So where I'm from is Alberta in Canada, which is the province right next to British Columbia. And so it's an inland population of grizzly bears that I really studied, kind of along the Rocky Mountains and within the Rocky Mountains. So what happens is the bears, they'll hibernate in the winter. They'll come out of the den in the spring, maybe around May. And during that time, there's not a lot for them to eat, really, because plants aren't really growing. What the key parts of their diet during that time is there's actually a root from a plant. It's called Hedysarum alpinum. That's a Latin name for one species. And so they'll actually dig up this root. And during the spring, and also in the fall again, the root of this plant's really nutritious. But what happens is over the summer, this plant grows. It takes all this nutrients and energy from the root, and it turns that into plant growth and flowers and reproduction and things like that. So in the middle of the summer, that root is actually kind of woody and not very nutritious. So in the spring and fall, bears will target this root. Another thing that bears will do in the spring is there's going to be a lot of young ungulates born, so like young moose and deer, and also there'll be some animals that have died over the winter, so their actual meat intake is often a bit higher in the spring and again in the fall. People don't know a lot about bears is that they're actually really can be really highly vegetarian. So through the spring or through the spring and the summer, bears will actually eat a lot of kind of green vegetation like grass, things like clover, all sorts of different plants that you can find in this ecosystem. And then once you get to the kind of late summer, fall, it's a really, really critical time for bears is because they're what becomes available then is things like fruit. And in some ecosystems, for example, maybe like the Yellowstone in the United States, there's these really kind of high-fat seeds from the whitebark pine tree. And so these plants really help, or the foods, like the fruit and the seeds are really high in either carbohydrate and fat, and that really helps the bears fatten up when they go into hibernation in the den, because they're going to be in there for 4 months or so, or to 6 months, and depending on the length of the, depending on what's going on with the weather. And also for females, they're also going to give birth in the den, and they're also going to have to lactate and nourish the cubs in the den. So it's really important that they gain enough weight, enough mass, to be able to do that. And so actually studies of captive bears, this was done in Washington State University. There's a captive bear facility. So basically bears that might have been problem bears or maybe orphan cubs, they'll take them to this facility and with an outdoor enclosure and all that sort of stuff. What they did there is they actually looked at what kind of ratio of macronutrients the bears selected. And they found that the bears preferred about 17% protein intake as a percentage of total energy intake. And with the remaining part, 83% being either carbohydrates or fats. So the bears really liked the fats. They preferred that. But what was interesting, if they fed them an experimental diet that was really low in fat, the bears would also eat, they'd make up the difference with carbohydrate, and they'd eat about 83% carbohydrate to maintain that stable protein intake. Interestingly, that's also the ratio, that preferred ratio of macronutrients that they selected is also the, what they showed was the optimal for them to gain mass, which is obviously very important before the hibernation period.
When the bears, as in this facility, actually had a choice as opposed to out in the wild, where they had to depend on what was available, and a lot of things were scarce in various seasons. But when they had the choice, they deliberately went for foods that were high in one of the food groups and not the other, like protein versus fat or vice versa.
Well, it's a bit more of a diet balancing thing. So they would eat certain proportions of foods with different ratios of macronutrients in them to kind of come to this preferred ratio of nutrients. So they would, so in one study, for example, or one diet they fed the bears actually was some defatted salmon. And then for the carbohydrate component, it was apples. So they'd eat between those two foods to create this ratio of macronutrients that they preferred. And that also optimized their mass gain.
I don't suppose we have any idea how they make these choices.
It's not a conscious choice as far as I know. I'm not an expert in that sort of physiology or that sort of regulation, but it's definitely been an evolved mechanism to, you know, evolve by natural selection to choose these sorts of things. The first year in my undergrad, when I'd go out and we'd do this, follow the bears around and then go try to see what they did, I was pretty much scared every day in a little way, because I thought, you know, there's a chance every day I could die. But what happened is at the end of the year, I didn't die. So the next year when I did that again, you know, I wasn't scared, but because I'd been through it. And the fact is we followed bears around all summer and we hardly ever saw them. They're very elusive. Also, the population density is maybe not so high in that ecosystem. That year, I wasn't afraid, but definitely had a healthy respect for them. So, yeah, you don't want to get complacent. You know, as far as bears, like whenever I came across a bear in the wild, especially black bears, we'd come across more of those, they would run away. Yeah, they would see us and they'd run away. So I never had any problems. One thing as far as bear-human conflict, so in North America, there's been studies. It was by Stephen Herrero, I think, at the University of Calgary.
Are they shy?
But he looked at attacks by black bears versus attacks on humans by grizzly bears. And it seems that for black bears, most attacks were predatory attacks by young males. So young male bears may be testing out people as a source of food. And then for the grizzly bear, it seemed like most of the attacks by grizzly bears were by females with cubs in more of a defensive situation where they felt threatened. So if we had a bear that was becoming aggressive, one thing bears will do is they'll give you what's called a bluff charge. So the bear will actually run at you full speed, and then just before it gets to you, it'll turn off a bit. And what you're supposed to do as a person is not run away, because that would be bad. You're supposed to just stand there and just take it. And hopefully it's a bluff charge in that case, or else it could be trouble. Another thing is we didn't walk around with rifles or anything as well. What we had is basically a capsicum spray that's called bear spray, just a really high concentration. And the studies, again, have shown that if you're using the bear spray, it's safer because there's less chance for you to get hurt or injured or killed. Basically, if the bear spray, I've seen the videos of it. I haven't actually used it on the bear, but it works really well. And the things with using a rifle or gun is you've got to be able to shoot the bear properly. You've got to be able to, you know, there's a lot more chance for danger. Whereas as far as the pepper spray goes, you spray it in the face and it takes off. There are some issues, though, especially when we were on really windy days when the wind was blowing in our face. So if we had to use pepper spray, it would have came back and immobilized us, perhaps more than the bear. So
there is an advertisement on Australian TV at present, and it shows bears on the other side of a tree standing up and scratching their backs. It's advertising something, nothing to do with bears. Do bears actually stand up and scratch their backs on the trunks of big trees?
Yeah, actually, I saw that commercial. Yeah, they do. That's certain trees that bears will do that on. They call those rub trees. So in the area I was in, they actually, I think they were trying to do a bit of a study on them. And they had some actual wildlife cameras out on this, and they'd show, it was a conference I was at, I saw this. Yeah, big male bear, you'd see it come up and it'd scratch its back on the tree. And then also, quite funnily, you'd see clips of little, really small bear cubs going and doing kind of the same thing. I'm not an expert in that area, but it's I think they think it's to do with some sort of scent communication sort of thing.
It certainly looks like it's just what sometimes you want on your own back.
Yeah, it does look appealing sometimes. I kind of started off with the grizzly bear stuff, and from there I morphed into looking at more of the nutritional ecology of other species.
To celebrate the success of 2SER's first ever podcast series, Just Words, we've teamed up with Audiocraft to bring you a live listening event on Thursday, May 18. Our podcast series has gone beyond the hype and headlines of Australia's racial discrimination laws, and you can watch the 2SER team record our final episode of Just Words live as we put 18C on trial and determine if our race hate laws really did murder free speech one last time. Come on down on Thursday, May 18, and listen to a mixture of live and recorded stories as we explore the new frontier of the culture wars. Doors open at 7 p.m. in Redfern at 107 Projects. Be sure to book your ticket now, as spaces are limited. To find out more, head to 2ser.com.
Actually, I came here to do my PhD. I didn't really have an experimental system to set up, but I actually became really interested in the Australian white ibis here, and I thought that'd be a really interesting question. Or to a really interesting species to investigate.
In what ways?
Well, as a foreigner coming to Australia, I think the first time I see the ibis, and you might see people in the gardens that are new to Australia doing this as well, but we'll see ibis and we'll be like, wow, that's a really cool bird. It's really pretty. Then I began to live here for a while, and I was like, all seeing ibis eating the garbage and things like that, and I'm like, that bird's kind of gross, actually. I don't know if I like that bird so much anymore. Actually, after I began working with them, I really, really, I liked them more and more every time.
You haven't told me why.
They're a lot of fun. I had a lot of fun with them. So basically what I wanted to do is what we have is with the ibis. You've probably talked to some other people about this before, is you have a native Australian species that's basically moving to the city and colonizing the city, and it's doing really, really well. And aspect that is they think that their ability to utilize human foods and garbage, things at the landfills or things that people are handing out, that might be a key part of why they're here and why they're doing so well. So I thought, okay, you know what, let's investigate this. There was a guy in our lab, his name's Gabriel Machovsky-Kapuska. He did a study looking at the common myna, the invasive myna bird that you see in the city. And he just basically went out and he fed them three different foods. It was a high protein, high fat, and high carbohydrate food. And he watched to see how these birds selected their diets. And those birds, actually, they really preferred high protein pellets almost exclusively. So it gives you a sense that if that's what they're really going for, that might be a macronutrient that's limiting to them in the urban environment. So I thought, okay, I want to try this with ibis. I initially thought, you know, this will be really easy. These birds are, you know, they'll get close to you and they'll try to steal your food there and all that sort of stuff and get in the bins. So what I did is I tried to do the same setup that he did, is basically I had a camera out and I put some plates out with some food on it to try to get the ibis to eat. But surprisingly, this was also in the Hyde Park and Royal Botanic Gardens here in Sydney. And basically the birds were really wary, actually, and I couldn't get them to eat my food for about 3 months. I kept playing around trying to get them to just come and feed and get them on film, but it wasn't working. So what I actually had to do is I just saw people picnicking the park with those plastic kind of takeaway containers. I've seen ibis eating out of those before, so I was like, I'm just going to do that. I'm going to pretend like I'm a picnicker. And I took a takeaway container, or basically it was more of a lunch container for lunch or whatever. And I made three compartments. I put in the high protein food, high carbohydrate food, and high fat foods. And then I just went to the park and I got the ibis attention. I put the dish down and eventually the ibis would come in and they'd feed. So after about 3 months of playing around, I got the experiment to work. What we found basically is that the ibis really liked the high carb pellets. It was interesting because actually if we looked at the natural diet of ibis, we see that they're poking around in the grass and in the wetlands. They're getting things like insects and crustaceans. They'll also eat just a little bit like other maybe small mammals or small like little lizards or things like that. But those types of foods are foods that are higher in protein and fat, these animal-based foods, and have very little carbohydrate, except for they're quite fond of earthworms here in the parks, actually. And earthworms have a little bit of carbohydrate in them, but not a lot as well. So what they were actually selecting from the experimental foods was different than what they eat naturally. And if we did a little bit of look at what's available in the human environment, and it suggests that of all just the relative proportion of foods available to humans, human foods are really high in carbohydrates, actually, just proportionally of the abundance of those types of foods. And also, I think these high carb foods are also a bit cheaper. And so it's more likely that someone would throw something away that's high carb, like some rice or some noodles or some bread, than they would throw away some steak or something high protein as well. So it might be a reason that the macronutrient preferences of the birds might be a reason why they're seem to be doing so well in the city and foraging and human refuse. So really interesting.
That is interesting. And again, it fits in with the argument you were giving earlier about how they are trying to balance out the kinds of nutrition that they're getting into their bodies. Now, isn't that funny? Because, you know, we are berated by the birdies often, but for feeding ibis things like chips and bits of bread. And in fact, it's their preference because they can get the good stuff from the ground or the banks of the river where they're nearby to, but they're not getting much in the way of carbo.
Just because an animal has a preference for something, might not be actually good because there could be a little bit of a mismatch. So if if the ibis kind of evolved in this low carbohydrate environment, basically, it might have evolved these appetite systems that kind of target carbohydrate because it's really rare. So it might be extra tasty for them. So then if they get into a situation in the city where there's a lot of carbohydrates and they've got this appetite for it, and then they end up essentially overeating that because of this mismatch between their evolved diet and their current environment, it could lead to some problems. Now, but I don't know. It seems like the ibis in the city are actually doing well. I don't know. Their population seems to be increasing. They seem to be relatively healthy, but I don't know. And it could be a situation you could say similar to humans, is that some people think that humans, for the most part, evolved in this low kind of carbohydrate environment, and we've evolved this these kind of tastes for fatty or high carbohydrate and kind of high or fatty sort of things. And so now in this current food environment we've created with all these ultra-processed foods and things like that, we've kind of created a mismatch in our own diet with our preferences with what's available, and then, you know, overeating all this low-carb, high-carb, and sort of, kind of high-carb or higher-fat sort of foods. I'm not exactly sure why the ibis are going for that. That's why it's a little bit of a mystery. But it could be definitely one of the reasons why they're doing so well here in the city, or at least are you know, able to live here so well.
And it's not only Sydney where they are abundant now. They were, I think, abundant up in Brisbane even before here. They both largely happened as a result of that terrible 7 or more year drought that we had some time ago. And there's quite a bit of work done by Darryl Jones and his mob up in Brisbane on the ibis. And in fact, they want to get in touch with your lot down here in Sydney because they're getting their stuff going again. Again, it was for the same reason, I think, initially, and that was, are they getting in the way of aeroplanes on airfields nearby?
Yeah, I've definitely come across their papers. That's good to know that they're interested in... I think all along the Australian East Coast, I think they've been kind of coming to the urban centres.
Now, do we know, are they bigger? Has anybody weighed them when, the ones that have first come over, as opposed to the ones we now have? I mean, are they becoming a bigger bird with this more abundant food source all the time?
That's a really good question. You know, there's not been a lot of research done on the ibis, actually, and I think there's a lot of potential to do a lot more. So, yeah, things like that, comparing their diet between these urban birds and the ones in the wild, and, you know, seeing what's going on that way. Yeah, there's all sorts of potential. But like I said, there's a bit of a research gap on them.
So what do you see as their, if you had to label them as a particular kind of food eater, what would you call them?
You know, if we look at their diet, and it's all animal-based, I found no evidence of them eating plant stuff in the literature, but I have seen them eat plant stuff like lettuce and carrots and stuff just in the gardens. I would say that their diet's been documented as being a carnivorous diet. So if you include insects, if you include like the yabbies, crustaceans, and things like that, yeah, I would say that they're kind of naturally carnivores. But if you look at other species of ibis, like I think it's the straw-necked ibis, just looking at some of the diet studies of them, they did find a significant amount of plant stuff in their diet, like grains and things like this. But again, there actually hasn't been a lot of diet studies on the white ibis as well. So it's something definitely to look into.
Well, they certainly don't seem to mind a decent handout of chips and bread.
Yeah, exactly. In the city, they're definitely don't seem to be carnivores. They seem to be omnivores.
Which I guess is something a lot of animals are, but aren't necessarily called that.
But you get to know the different birds and different personalities. Some that aren't, they do have different personalities. There's some birds that aren't tagged as well that'll have maybe a droopy wing or a chipped bill. And they'll behave in different ways. And there's definitely a dominance hierarchy when I was feeding them as well. Like the big males, if they wanted, they'd eat first, and then they'd leave, and then the other birds would, the next dominant bird would come in. And that was actually part of the study I looked, is because when I did feed the ibis, typically a whole bunch would come to eat as well, and some birds would run in and try to sneak food. And what we found is that actually that indiscriminate feeding by these birds that were running in to sneak the food in the presence of this more dominant individual it actually caused the proportion of fat pellets that were consumed to increase, just because that was the least preferred pellet that that I had for them to eat. And just the act of this random feeding kind of significantly increased the amount of that. So there could be a there was a little bit of a indication that these subdominant animals may be getting less than an optimal diet, just based on the competition alone. Like I said, it was hard to feed some of them. So the ones in Hyde Park, they're really habituated to humans. So, and they're used to being fed. They're being fed. So it was easy to approach them, but there were some guys in botanic gardens that weren't. So I had a few birds that they weren't my enemies, but they were, they didn't like me. So if you look at the wing tag birds, I think it was 42, and 42 hung out with 11 and 17 kind of, kind of towards the city end of the park where that big fountain is. And those birds, I tried to feed them, and they would see me, and they would just fly away. But there was another group of birds near the Conservatory High School, one with a wing tag 81, who was quite good, actually. I would see that bird, and I would call to it. I'd say, hey, 81, and she would come over to me, and I'd just put the food down, and she would eat that. Sometimes she would see me first and come over to me before I even saw her, and then I'd feed her. So she's quite good. She was my favorite one, actually.
On the program today, you heard from Sean Coogan from the School of Environmental and Life Sciences at the University of Sydney. Thank you so very much, Sean, and I'm sure you don't need good luck with your submitted thesis, but congratulations on the paper you've just had published, and I hope your thesis is approved very quickly.
You might call it the softer side of Mac DeMarco.
Look in the mirror, who do you see?
It's actually called This Old Dog, and we're calling it the 2SER feature album this week. We'll get out of the garage and croon along to Mac DeMarco all week on 2SER. 2SER supporters can win copies. This Old Dog from Mac DeMarco, the feature album on 2SER 107.3. Stories, ideas, music.
Of all the things you wished you'd never done, I've heard you say that this is number one.
On the program today, we heard from Sean Coogan. Story and sound files are on the AQOB website, www.aqob.com.au. We'll be back again next week at the same time, and in the meanwhile, please take care of the environment. Bye-bye. Troubles with meeting.